agreement between the United States and Afghanistan, we will complete our mission and end the war in Afghanistan. By the end of 2014, the Afghans will be fully responsible for the security of their country.
In this regard, Hamid Karzai and Barack Obama signed an agreement called the Strategic Partnership Agreement in 2012. The American forces handed over security responsibilities of Afghanistan to local security forces for 2 years. A small number of remaining American soldiers started training and supporting the Afghan army. On December 28, 2014, NATO seemingly ended its military operations. Number of American troops in Afghanistan decreased a lot compared to the past. When NATO forces couldn't stop the Taliban, how could the Afghan army fight against them? But the West's plan to prevent the advance of the Taliban did not end here, because there was a more important issue on the table. In the process of peace negotiations, when the Afghan political delegation met with the Pakistani and sometimes American officials, John Kerry provided Karzai with classified information about Mullah Muhammad Omar's whereabouts and movements. The American and Pakistani officials continue providing the classified information for Karzai during the years of peace negotiations. According to Asim Salim Bajwa, a former spokesman of the Pakistan Army, Karzai knew about Mullah Muhammad Omar's death during his visit to Pakistan in 2013. Of course, this news remained a secret until 2015 and the new government of Afghanistan under the presidency of Ashraf Ghani. On July 15, 2015, Abdul Hasib Sadegh, the former spokesman of Afghanistan's General Directorate of National Security, officially announced that Mullah Muhammad Omar died in a hospital in Karachi, Pakistan. But what was the motivation to keep it a secret and, on the other hand, to publish this news suddenly and publicly? This news was published exactly 1 day before talks between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. This action was defined based on the policy to control the Taliban. Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
This will certainly impact peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, because it'll be very difficult for the Taliban to focus on talks when it's going through a leadership crisis.
They thought the Taliban faced a leadership crisis and it could affect their unity in negotiations. And finally, the Taliban's advances in Afghanistan were also controlled after the collapse of negotiations.
Not to get fixated on a characterization of the Taliban that fits your own view of what you need to do. So if you are advocating a strategy of splintering and peeling away, you're going to naturally look for fissures in the organization and lack of cohesion in the organization.
Splintering the Taliban was the best way to weaken this organization. The announcement of the death of the founder of the Taliban gave an opportunity to the people who were previously expelled from the organization by Mullah Omar. Later, they were used to weaken the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Omar had fired some Taliban leaders in the past due to violations of the rules. Mansur Dadullah was Mullah Dadullah's brother. Mullah Omar dismissed him from the Taliban organization because of his insubordination in negotiations with foreign parties and involvement in the assassination of Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Mullah Muhammad Omar also dismissed Abdul Manan Niazi due to extensive financial corruption.
since the death of Mullah Omar, we have seen the Taliban have become increasingly decentralized, both horizontally and vertically. They have also become relatively incoherent. They have also splintered across different factions and groups that are now operating under different flags and different leaders.
In this situation, the media added flame to the fire.
Mullah Omar, I mean, we've had reports that he might be dead many times before. What does it tell us, if indeed these reports are correct, that he has indeed been dead for 2 years?
On the flip side, people like General John F. Campbell, former commander of the Resolute Support Mission and United States Forces, Afghanistan, instill doubt and ambiguity in the Afghan society.
You know, a couple weeks, middle of July time frame, when the announcement of Mullah Omar's death came out, you got to think to yourselves, you know, he's been dead for 2 years. Why didn't the regular Taliban know about that? Somebody that was deceiving everybody. I think what's happening right now is they're trying to figure out who is going to lead the Taliban. Is it Mansour? Is it Zakir? Is it Yaqub? Is it Manan?
And Amrullah Saleh, former head of the National Security Directorate, the NDS, of Afghanistan. In such a critical situation, the Taliban Supreme Council appointed Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour as the new leader. Under the leadership of Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour, some Taliban leaders reopened old wounds. Tayyip Aga was the head of the Taliban's political office in Doha, Qatar. Sayyid Mohammad Tayyip Aga resigned after Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour came to power and left the world of politics. But not all the disaffected members of the Taliban took the same measures. In some cases, they used weapons and started wars. Mullah Muhammad Rasul's insurgency was the most important sign of the beginning of a war against the Taliban. In a strange way, the BBC covered this meeting that was held in the outskirts of Herat. On November 10th, 2015, Mullah Muhammad Rasul officially announced himself as leader of the Taliban in a big meeting in Herat. He could have many followers afterwards. Mullah Muhammad Rasul and his supporters basically didn't consider Mullah Akhtar Mansour to be the leader of the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Rasul appointed Abdul Manan Niazi and Mansour Dadullah as the deputies of provinces in the west and south of Afghanistan. Mansour Dadullah entered into direct military conflict with the new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour. In 2015, Mansour Dadullah was killed in Zabul province in the conflict with the Taliban. Mullah Mansour Dadullah's death marked the end of the activities of rebel groups in southern Afghanistan. Mullah Akhtar Mansour's forces concentrated on Herat to destroy the western faction of the insurgent movements led by Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour decided to put down the rebellion once and for all. But the U.S. directly intervened to defend Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, former leader of the Taliban, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in collaboration with the Afghan government, decided to kill him.
Mansour was a threat to that effort, and this action sends a clear message to the world that we will continue to stand with our Afghan partners.
The Taliban Central Council appointed Habibullah Akhundzada as the new leader after the assassination of Mullah Akhtar Mansour. Under the leadership of Hibatullah Akhundzada, the conflict between Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi and the Taliban continued. After 2016, Mullah Muhammad Rasul's forces had only one main and serious faction that was led by Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi in the provinces from the southwest to the northwest. In 5 to 6 years of his leadership, Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi was able to attract the loyalty of some of the Afghan tribes and fight against the Taliban. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi called Khunzada a mercenary and dependent person. He called the forces under the leadership of Mullah Hibatullah Khunzada as fake Taliban supporters and soldiers of fortune. On the contrary, he called his organization the Supreme Council of the Taliban and considered himself as the true successor of Mullah Omar. He also considered himself as the future Amirul Mu'mineen of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. War with all of Afghanistan's neighbors does not match any political logic. He also criticized and complained about the countries of the region that were occupied by the U.S. or its allies. In this situation, he never criticized Saudi Arabia, Israel, or the Daesh terrorist group. But we don't know who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. The New York Times, in an article published on June 19, 2017, explained in detail who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. This article suggested the Afghan intelligence agency paid each member of this group salaries equivalent to $150 to $300 a month to fight against the Taliban and Afghanistan's neighbors.
The splinter Taliban groups and lower level commanders from the main movement, which would be the Afghan Taliban or the Quetta Shura, and from the battlefield, and slowly integrate them into the Afghan government. And this would bring or pressure the Taliban top leadership.
In the battlefield, when Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi's forces were under pressure, the Afghan army helped them and took the wounded soldiers to government hospitals for treatment. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi had also mentioned his cooperation with the Afghan army. In fact, the secret cooperation between the Afghan government and Abdul Manan Niazi was a plan to weaken and destroy the Taliban. But this tragedy failed, and Mullah Manan Niazi was eventually killed in a clash with the Taliban in Herat. Although he claimed to be an invincible leader, his death broke the chain of this breakaway faction in western Afghanistan.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us. Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. فأوحينا إلى موسى أن اضرب بعصاك البحر فانفلق فكان كل فرق كالطود العظيم.
Then we inspired to Moses, strike with your staff the sea, and it parted, and each portion was like a great towering mountain.
وأزلفنا ثم الآخرين.
And we advanced thereto the pursuers.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 63rd verse of chapter Shu'ara. فَأُحَيْنَا إِلَى مُوسَىٰ أَنْ يَضْرِبْ بِعَصَاكَ الْبَحْرِ فَانْفَلَقَ فَكَانَ كُلُّ فِرْقٍ كَالطَّوْدِ الْعَظِيمِ. Then we revealed to Moses, strike the sea with your staff. Then it clove asunder, and each part became like a huge mountain. The 64th verse also says, وَأَزْلَفْنَا ثَمَّ الْآخَرِينَ. Then we made the other party approach thither. So in this verse, the Almighty Allah explains the escape route Allah provided for Moses. Allah who rules everything. And if waters get wavy, it is because of His command. If storms take place, it is by His order. And who created the universe, the water, wind, and soil are under His authority. He is the one who commands waves of the sea to pile. They became like two huge mountains, and roads appear between them. And every group of Israel, every group of children of Israel, chose one of them to pass. Now, Pharaoh and his men got really astonished by seeing this scene, and they saw such a miracle with their own eyes, but they did not stop being conceited. They still continue pursuing Moses and the children of Israel. They seek their final destiny as they approach them. So the Holy Quran says, وَأَزْلَفْنَا ثَمَّ الْآخَرِينَ. Then we made the other party approach thither. Therefore, unaware of the fact that they are going to die, and the divine command of punishment would be soon issued, Pharaoh and his ignorant men entered the marine roads that was opened in the middle of the sea, and they ran arrogantly after their former slaves who had disobeyed them and who had believed in the Lord of the worlds and His Prophet.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
series
of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the people of Pharaoh continued pursuing the Banu Israel in the middle of the sea. The 65th verse says, وَأَنْجَيْنَا مُوسَى وَمَنْ مَعَهُ أَجْمَعِينَ, and we saved Moses and those with him altogether. Allah's way of treatment has always been to assist the truth and to destroy the wrong throughout the history. And this is the case as with this verse of the Holy Quran. The noble verse says, and we saved Moses and those with him altogether. وَأَنْجَيْنَا مُوسَى وَمَنْ مَعَهُ أَجْمَعِينَ. And this means deliverance and salvation can only be gained by following the divine prophets and believing in Allah. And the second point, relying on Him, is the secret to victory. And in the worst condition, Allah has promised to save His friends from the deadlocks and from the dead ends. And this is a sign of the Almighty Allah. إِنَّ مَعْيَ رَبِّي سَيَهْدِينَ. And this is what happens. The sea being cloven asunder and the pharaohs being drowned, these are the signs of the power and the wrath of Allah, which must be the cause of admonition. We must understand and tell the others what is going to happen if we lose our hope in the middle of the challenges. Just when the last member of children of Israel came out of the sea and the last member of the host of Pharaoh entered the sea, Allah orders the water of the sea to return to its first state. The huge raging waves fell down, they came together, they joined each other, and they took Pharaoh and his host, just like some straw, with them here and there, and they completely destroyed them. ثم أغرقنا الآخرين, the 66th verse says, then we drowned the others. So in a very short moment, everything finished. Those captivated slaves easily became free, and those proud tyrants, they were completely annihilated. This is the beginning of the change of the history of that people. The period of those arrogant people ended, and the oppressed people inherited their land as well as their government. Thank you for staying with us. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on RIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking and responding to a very important question. And that question is regards to the legitimacy of the birth of non-Muslims. Meaning, should we consider non-Muslims as illegitimate or should we consider them to be legitimately born? What is the answer to this question? In order to answer this question, we have to take something into consideration, and that question is this, that the relation of marriage is one of the necessary elements of every human society, and it was established for the protection, the sustainment, and subsistence of human progeny, and there's no recourse but for this institution to be established. Therefore, it's only natural that in every nation, in every religion, the institution of marriage was present, it existed, and obviously, this institution, it took on different forms in different eras and different religions. This is obvious. At the same time, we know that these differences does not cause the nature of the institution of marriage to change. I mean, it doesn't cause that those ceremonies to become something else, and for their essences to change and not be considered marriages, to the extent that, according to Islam, the marriage is conducted in every nation, in every religion, before or even now, it's considered these as acceptable, and therefore the children born from these marriages, we consider them legitimate. For example, we have a riwayat, a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which he said that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, do not curse the polytheists, right? Do not curse them, because every nation has its own form of marriage, right? Right? This kind of indicates that these marriages were considered legitimate, and the children born for them were considered legitimate children, not illegitimate children, right? And we also have another hadith, again, narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi salam prohibited Muslims from cursing, their non-Muslim slave girls. And he said you shouldn't say that, you know, shouldn't call them and curse them by calling them illegitimate, right? Because, and the Prophet says that every nation had its own form of marriage, right? So this indicates kind of that marriage is conducted in those other religions. Islam accepted them as legitimate, and therefore the children born from them were legitimate children. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has also been reported to have said, "Do you not know that every group of people, every nation has its own form of marriage by means of which they stay away from fornication?" So this clearly indicates that this is acceptable in Islam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at whether non-Muslims are considered legitimate or not. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Aperture. Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 नवंबर 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafi. He was the first to occupy the house.
उसके बाद
On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought three small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and four sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving two academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bilashuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Max Nagrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elie Nicolson.
In Heidelberg, He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We then begin this sermon the way the Commander of the Faithful used to begin his, by advising us, Usikum ibadallah bittaqwallah, that we advise you, O the servants of God, to be God-conscious, God-fearing, and pious human beings. We had stated that inshallah we will be beginning a new series, and it's about how to combat the desires that we have, how to fight the nafs that we have to ensure that it remains in the path that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants it to be. What I want to talk about today in a little bit of detail is understanding the soul of a human being, right? And what we're about to describe, it sounds as though it is like fiction, you know, but it's not. It's a reality, but it's something that we're just not aware of or not paying attention to. Our soul or our existence, let's look at our existence. Our existence is composed of two environments, yeah? The first environment is the worldly existence that we have, that we see. And this is the realm of the body. Yeah, this is where our physical self remains. And then there is a spiritual existence that's simultaneous to our physical existence. And this is the realm of the soul, where the soul lives. The soul inhabits both the physical realm and the spiritual realm. You're going to have to stay with me today, okay? Two realms of existence, physical realm, spiritual realm. The soul exists in both. That's why we have a soul inside of us. It exists in this physical realm and it exists in the spiritual realm. Its ascension takes place in the spiritual realm. So whatever we see, like we think that, oh, I'm not feeling a difference now. If I had the ability to see what's happening in the spiritual realm, I would see every action having an effect on my soul, right? In both of these existences, right, there are two guards or two hosts who are battling one another for supremacy. There is the divine hosts and then there are the satanic hosts. Yeah, they exist within us. This is the promise of Iblis, wasn't it? that I will flow through the blood of Bani Adam, except for those who are utterly pure. But everybody else